Let's get started. Good afternoon. It's very bright. I've got two great big bright lights, like I'm being interrogated or something. But I'll try and give you some useful information. Please don't torture me. Okay, so this is a deep dive into the Azure Container Service, and it's billed as a level 400 session, which means that some of you might be expecting some very technical stuff. But I was on the booth for a whole day yesterday figuring out, you know, just what kind of audience there is here. This is the first time I've been to Ignite. And it turns out there's a lot of people who just need the basics of what containers are as well. So we are going to give what's pretty much close to a 400, but we might not be going quite as deep as some of you would like. Very happy to help those people understand a bit more, but we're also going to make sure those people who just don't have the 101 understanding yet are brought up to speed as well. So just so I can get a feel for what kind of pace we should be taking, I'd like to ask a few questions. How many people here have run the command docker run? Okay, about half of you. It's not going to be totally 400 level. Only half of you have run a docker run. How many people have done a docker build? Okay, about the same number. How many people have deployed a multiple container application, so a single application made up of multiple containers? A lot less. Okay. So that's the level we're pitching at, guys. Okay. So here we go. We're going to start off straight away with a demo. I'll start with introducing myself since I'm going to be talking most today. My name's Ross Gardler. I'm a program manager on Azure Container Service. I'm joined by two colleagues. Saria here, who's going to be doing some demos, is also a PM with me working at Microsoft. And Ken is working at one of our partners at Mesosphere. So you'll learn more about those as I introduce them. And Ken is actually the first one up here. We're going to start with a demo straight away, because a lot of the questions I got on the booth yesterday were, why all this interest in containers? What's it about? What can I do with these things? And so Ken is going to give us a very quick introduction to this. Don't worry if you can't follow what's going to go on. So we're then going to roll it back. We're going to do the 101, and we're going to build through to how you actually build a full-blown application. So, Ken, do you want to go with the first demo? What number were you?
I'll do it. That'd be great. Number one. I'm number one, of course. All right. So they say that software is eating the world, and I'd like to add to that that it's being sliced and served in containers. The starting point for most people, most organizations when we're dealing with containers, is Docker, and it's almost always developers. And then something interesting happens. And that interesting thing is, how do I run that in production? So there's a need for another step beyond where Docker is at, and we've created what we call DCOS, which is the Data Center Operating System, which I'm going to demo for you. So just like on your operating system, can you imagine launching a browser and being prompted with a request of, hey, which processor do you want to run this on? That'd be weird, right? Like, that would not be acceptable behavior. What is the difference, then, between a one-node, 100-core machine and a 10-node, 10-core machine cluster? And the difference is, on the one node, I have a scheduler. It manages everything for me. I don't have to worry about any prioritization, any of that stuff. Isn't that awesome? And essentially, that's what we've done when we talk about DCOS. It's a data center operating system. So all the things you expect from an operating system, the ability to install. Why don't we look at that real quick? Let me pull over here. This is the DCOS interface. With this interface, we have the ability to look at applications we may want to install in what we refer to as the universe. These are packages. And for our demo, in fact, why don't we go ahead and install one of these from the UI? So I'm going to go in here and say Marathon LB and say install. Now, the beauty of what just happened there is I have a 10-node cluster. In fact, I could come out here to the command line and say DCOS node and get a listing of nodes that are out there. Whoops. And because my screen was a little less font, there are 10 plus 1, so 11. And the 10-node cluster is the private nodes. The one extra cluster is in the public space, and you're going to learn a lot more about those details later on. And I didn't have to tell it where to go. I didn't say anything about where this should land. All those instructions, that behavior, the constraints, all that information is stored elsewhere or is just pseudo-random, which is great, right? You don't have to worry about it. And of course, we have the ability to do fault tolerant or fault domain management, where this thing, if it were to fail, would launch in the appropriate way. So I have a little bit of notes here just to make the life easy for me. This would be how I would install it if I were installing it from the command line. Let me take this app here, whoops, and install another application, which is an autoscaler, if I type it fully. And what we can do is we can go to the other UI, which is Marathon, that's running underneath the covers, so we can see that I am actually launching something. And just to complete this out, I have Nginx that I'm launching. I have a thing called Siege, which is actually just an application that's hammering on top of Marathon. And if what we can do here is we can see that all those applications are running, and at this resolution, which I did not practice with, I can see that each one of these is running one instance, but I could also go in here and say I want to scale that. And let's say we're scaling that to 15, or maybe we want to scale it to something large. Let's scale it to 50. Now, at this time, I'm scaling something that is hammering on the other applications. Because of that, it needs to respond. In that response, we see that we are adjusting. If you zoom in a little bit, you'll see that Nginx is auto-adjusted to 7 now. If we were to scale down, it would also respond in like manner. So we have the ability to launch applications from the command line. I could actually scale them from the command line. I have a RESTful endpoint where I could automate this with whatever services are integrated with whatever I have in my data center. And that's kind of where we see the future going. And I'm going to hand it off to Sori.
All right, I'm going to do a one-on-one on Windows Server containers. So let me just switch the monitor to 8. Yes. Yep. So this is a Windows Server TP5 image. I'm just going to show you the details of this. So I'll do Docker info. And you can see, okay, that I'm running Windows Server 2016 Data Center Technical Preview 5. And there are no containers running. I can also show that using Docker PS. So you can see there's nothing running. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to start a simple container. It's going to be an IIS container, and I'll show you when I hit the endpoint, you're going to see the IIS splash screen. So let me do a Docker run. So what I'm doing here in this command is I'm telling, run me an IIS server that I've pre-built in the interest of time, and run it in detach mode, which is -D, and I'm saying use port -P, port 443 on the host machine, and connect it to port 80 on the container, and I'm going to run this. And you can see how quickly the container started up. And I'm going to go to my browser and hit the endpoint. So that's it. And as you can see, how quickly a container started up. So let me go ahead and move to, yes, what is that?
Five,
okay. So let me talk a little bit about the advantages of using containers and Docker. The first advantage is the fact that it's faster. It's faster because we are no longer spinning up an entire OS stack. Containers, as you know, share the kernel space. They just package binaries and libraries in the application and start the container up, and which is why they are fast. It's portable. What that means is because you are using the standard Docker set of tools, you are packaging them in Docker containers, and anywhere there's Docker engine installed on any machine, you can deploy them without having to say that it runs on my machine but doesn't run on your machine because you don't have the dependencies. It improves the dev cycle. And why does it improve the dev cycle? Now you are able to use the standard set of commands, very small set, Docker build, Docker run. There's of course more to it, but with these few set of commands and the fact that you can push and pull from the registry and the fact that you can run it on all machines that have Docker Engine installed on it, it becomes faster. And what that means is the op cycle use the same commands, the same set of easy commands to start up containers and run them, and the ability to build them helps them fasten the op cycle. Now, all of this combined together, the fact that it is fast, portable, and that the And the fact that the DevSops cycle becomes faster makes you more agile to build an application and deploy it into production. So how did we do that? Let's look at some code. I have something called as the Docker file. Most of you must have been familiar with this. It's the simple way of deploying a Docker container. The first step is, so this is a very simple format. There are more details that you can put into this. What the first line is it tells from where you're going to run the container. You're going to give it a base image, like the one that I run. It was from Windows Server container, and it was an IIS image already existing in the Docker Hub registry. And you do copy some content. You copy code from source to destination. The source is basically your local file system, and then the destination is the container workload. And you run a simple command. The simple command is like you could run start up a PowerShell PowerShell tool or a command line or tell it to run commands. So the Docker file in the simplest format is like this, but then you could add more information. There are more tags like labels wherein you give metadata information. There is something called as N wherein you give all your environment variables. So it's end to end. There's quite a lot of it. And there are also articles on how to, the best practices on to write Docker files. So what does this mean? What does this mean to the build and run cycle of an application? What is the dev? So say we have a developer today who's writing code, and he wants to make a small change. Once he makes the small change, he can use the simple command of Docker build and give it a tag. A tag is basically associated with the build to identify the container image that you are deploying. And he can run Docker build and build the container. The next step, of course, is to test it out by running it. And he's going to run it by giving the same container name that he tagged with. Now, of course, before deploying to production, you will have to test it out. What that means is, again, in the test environment, you're going to have to build it and make sure that it actually builds and is not broken, and then you run it. You could either do it in a simple way, have somebody do it, or you could set up a CI server like Jenkins to do it for yourself. And once you do that, you push the container to a repository, a central repository that you have. It could either be on Docker Hub or a private registry that you've set up. Now, when you come to the ops cycle, the fact that you have to deploy it to a production environment, you can have the ops guys run the same command again. It's Docker run and using the same container name that you have. So all of this, as you can see, it's a standard Docker tool set. It's very simple to use, and it makes life a lot easier for everyone. Now, what I've shown you is basic 101 of running one container application. In reality, when your application has lots of moving parts, lots of containers that talk to each other and run in production. Ross is going to take from here and talk to you about deploying complex applications on ACS. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Surya. So as Surya said, what we've seen is the 101. This was Windows Server containers, but it's exactly the same if it was Linux. And everything we're going to look at from the rest of this on is Linux containers. And we also saw at the very beginning there the end goal, this ability to auto-scale, to build big applications, et cetera. So we're going to build now from this 101 all the way through to being able to see how to build and deploy that large auto-scaling application. And in order to do that, you need what's already been talked about. You need a number of agents, a number of nodes on which these containers are going to run. And then you need some way of deciding where they're going to run. You saw DCOS from Ken, and you also saw Swarm from Surya. And that's what we have in Azure Container Service. Why a choice? Because choice is good. There's a lot of innovation in this space right now, and there are advantages and disadvantages to each of those orchestrators. There's also the need to be able to choose what's optimal for your space, what's the right thing for you to run on. But the key thing of what we deploy in Azure Container Service is that it's only open source code. So everything that we're doing inside of Container Service is open source code, and that means something very important. You can take the exact same setup and run it wherever you want. You can run it on your laptop. You can run it in your dev environment. You can run it in the cupboards, in the machines in the cupboard, or your multi-million dollar data center. You can even run it on a competitive cloud if you want to. You're not going to want to, but you could. And so what that means is you not only have portability of the containers, which is something that Saria talked about, that this Docker image format and the standard way of building these containers gives you portability of container. You're also going to have portability of your application, so multiple containers. So when you've defined all the rules and how things want to be deployed and you send your containers out across your cluster like this, it doesn't matter where your cluster is running. You can use the same open source tooling to deploy it wherever you want. So what exactly are we providing? If the software is all open source, what are we providing inside of Azure Container Service? Well, first of all, we're providing infrastructure. And I'm guessing that you've heard a few presentations claiming that Azure is the best cloud in the world. We're the enterprise cloud, we're the hybrid cloud, et cetera. It's all true. And that's why the infrastructure is really, really important. We're providing world-class infrastructure on which to build and run your container applications. We're partnering with key people in the ecosystem. We're leveraging the innovation that we're seeing in the ecosystem through people like Mesosphere, where Ken works, but also Docker. You heard the announcement yesterday morning about a further engagement with Docker to bring you the commercially supported Docker engine inside of Windows Server 2016. But these are the open source pieces at this point, because we want that portability. Once you have that, we make it easy for you to deploy. So we provide an ARM template. Azure Container Service is a resource provider. So we take the many thousands of lines of code that it takes to configure the infrastructure and the software that is running on top of it, and we distill that down to just tens of lines of ARM configuration code. We also provide CLI, et cetera, et cetera. And so you don't have to worry about how to optimize that software to run in Azure. We worry about that for you. You don't have to worry about how to run it on-premise either, because our partners are specializing running these things on-premise. But it is open source, so you can worry about it if you want to. If you're the kind of company who wants to control it, wants to have your engineers working hands-on with the code, you can do it. It's open source. And so you don't have to worry about this if you're going to be running it in Azure, which means you can focus on your application. You don't have to worry about the infrastructure on which you're running it. And so we have a guideline. I won't call it a rule because sometimes things change, but we definitely have a very strong guideline that we do not reach above that line between the orchestration and of the infrastructure and the containers themselves into the application layer. We don't do that. There are environments that will do that. There's plenty of PaaS platforms that will do this, and they have opinions about how you should build your application. And that can bring significant advantages if the decisions made in that PaaS platform suit your use case, but it's significant disadvantages if it doesn't suit your use case. So we don't go above that level, but if you do want to go about above that level, if you do want to have the benefits of a more PaaS-like environment, you can use the products that come from our partners. The one on the left there is Docker Data Center. You have Mesosphere. Because we're building on the standard open source technologies, there are lots of others that you can build on top of this container service as well. So what does it look like? Over there on the left, those are the masters. That's where all the orchestration software runs. We install and configure the software. That's where you run the commands. So the commands that you saw Ken and Saria running, they're running through that load balancer and through the NAT connection into those containers, and they're executing on the masters. This middle box is your public agent nodes. This is where any container that needs access to the outside world or is going to be accessed from the outside world, they're going to run here. So typically, you'll put your load balancer on there. You saw Ken deploy a load balancer. That's where it went. It went onto the public node because the load balancer needs to be able to talk to the outside world. On the right-hand side is the private agents. These are not accessible directly to the outside world. So when you deploy your Nginx applications, like Ken did earlier on, or your IIS application that Saria did, that goes onto the private nodes, and you route through it, through the load balancer, and so on. Now, I often get asked, why do I have to have my own load balancer inside of the container application? Why can't I just use the Azure load balancer? Well, you can. You don't have to have a containerized load balancer inside your application. But if you use the Azure load balancer, you've got some configuration of your application dependent on the infrastructure that you're running it on, which reduces your portability. Fine, you can do that. It's a good choice. There are some advantages in doing it. Taking out another hop in the network, for example, can be a significant advantage. But we don't require you to do it. You might want to be able to run the whole application in a different environment, on your developer's laptops, on your test center, wherever. If you build containers into your, load balancers into your application, you can do that with no code changes. So what all this does is it allows you to build for flexibility, to build your applications for flexibility. And as Sorya said in his introduction, it brings a lot of agility to you. You can be agile all the way through from dev all the way through to ops. And what this is doing is it's making real many of the promises of the DevOps movement that is beginning to lose its shine right now. But there is a lot of benefits through having the agility and the flexibility that this kind of infrastructure provides you. But what should my application look like? How do I build an application that's containerized? If you imagine that this is just a small part of an e-commerce application, the piece on the left is doing order processing, and it's got stock control, and it's got picking lists and things like that. And then you've got the picker, which is a human being, going out into the warehouse and filling in a report and so on. On the right-hand side, you've got the finance systems. The finance systems know how much stock is worth, what the value of the company is, what outstanding invoices there are, etc. And then you have the stock item, which is kind of a boundary object between those two systems. So this, when you draw it like this, looks like a monolithic app. And I'll bet many people in this room have an application that's monolithic. It looks like this. It's probably got a whole bunch of other things attached to it. That can be a container. If it runs on a VM, it can run in a container. There's nothing magic about the software that you're building here. But putting it in a container gives you some significant advantages. How many people have heard the term microservices? Yeah, not surprising. Pretty much everybody. It's a buzzword that's around at the moment, and people love microservices. I try not to use the term microservices. I'm going to say it about 5 times in the next few minutes, and then hopefully I won't say it again. The reason I don't like microservices is because of those people who said they'd heard of it, how many of you feel you can define what a microservice is? Not one person. Not even me. And I'm on the stage. I have no idea what a microservice is. Is it this big or is it this big? Do I care whether it's that big or that big? It's the promise of microservices that's important, not the actual name microservices. Now, there is a great book, apart from the fact it has the name microservices in the title, by Sam Newman. Sam Newman spends about 350 pages, and I took two things from his book. I took lots of things, but two things that are in these slides. The first one is he talks about microservices give you loose coupling. That's the idea that a change in one part of the system doesn't affect another part of the system. And high cohesion. Related behavior should stick together in one place, and unrelated behavior goes elsewhere. Now, does anybody remember why we were so excited about service-oriented architectures, about object-oriented, about et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Do you remember, or do you have a question? You remember, yeah. And down here too. I do, and there's been loads of things over the time. This is not a new concept. This is not about microservices. This is about how we should be building software. So that's why I don't use the term microservices. I like to talk about smaller services. And containers give you all the benefits of smaller services. Now, don't get me wrong, microservices have their place. There's some great innovations happening in that area, but don't equate containers to microservices. You can do microservices in containers. You don't have to do microservices in containers. You can do monoliths, like the other version of this slide. The colors aren't showing up so well, but what I'm trying to show here is you can break that monolithic application up into two separate components. The logical breaking initially would be the order processing system on the left and the finance system on the right. Okay, that's great. Now I can scale up the order processing faster than I can scale, or independently rather, of the finance system, which is likely what I actually want to do in reality. I just want to run a report every now and again, make sure I've got the right data, but I don't need to respond to orders instantly in the finance system. As long as it happens at some point, I'm happy. Whereas responding to orders in the left-hand side, that needs to happen quickly whenever we need to. Then you get to the point, you say, well, actually, you know that forklift and the picker who's going around the warehouse and filling in a form to say, yes, I've done that, that kind of goes at human speed. It doesn't go at computer speed. So you don't actually have to have that scaling up at the same time as your order processing system that's checking you actually have stock in and responding back to the customer. So maybe then you break those apart. You could go all the way and say, well, actually, everything should be a separate service. The point of this is, I don't know what a microservice is. I don't know what point breaking this down it becomes a microservice versus a monolith. But I do know that breaking it down is something that I want to do, and I do know that containers make that really easy for me. And we'll show exactly how that works in the next demo. Sam Newman, this is the second thing I want to quote to you from his book. You really should read the book. It's called Building Microservices. It's from O'Reilly. It's an excellent book. I've never yet put it up there and somebody say, why are you quoting this guy? Everybody who comments says it's great. He says, towards the monolithic side. There's a number of reasons why he says that. The first one is that if you get the boundaries wrong, it can create problems. You can create chatty services. He's also saying that moving the boundaries in is much easier than moving them out. Okay, so on the side of monolithic. I've got a third reason why I think this is very good advice. We actually are pretty good at building monoliths. Yes, they have their limitations because we can't scale them, we can't be as agile as we want to, etc. But we can build them in a fairly reliable way. So let's build them, put them in containers, break them down, separate them out as we need to, rather than as we think we might need to. So in summary, bypass the temptation to decompose too early. So what does that look like in practice? Just move these drinks before I spill them over everything. And now I've got to type my password in. I'll put it up on the screen in a moment. There we go. And I'm on 7. Okay, so you saw a moment ago, you saw DCOS. This is a slightly older version of DCOS. This is 1.7, whereas the version that Ken was showing is 1.8. I need to upgrade this demo to use 1.8, which I have tested it. It just works. What we have here is something that's similar to that application that we talked about earlier on. So the idea is that we have an order processing system. The producer, right down the fourth one down, each of these is a container, by the way. So the producer container, the fourth one down, is going to simulate orders coming into the system. And right now, there is none of those running. So there's no work coming into the system at this point. When work comes in, it goes into a queue. And so the information on the left there is what the current queue length is. And the processing time is how long it took to process the last thing that was in the queue. So that was about 20 minutes ago before I came in. So then the analyzer at the top, that's the thing that's doing the order processing. That's the bit that needs to respond back to the customer. And let's imagine our SLA is we give an answer back to the customer about whether their order is valid within 1.5 seconds. Okay? Autoscale is similar to the autoscale that Ken used earlier on. It looks at the length of the queue and the current processing time, and it manages the workloads in the cluster according to that. And then batch is a lower priority job. Let's imagine it's doing data mining, or it's doing the finance reporting, or it's doing something that needs to happen, but it doesn't need to happen within 1.5 seconds. It just needs to happen at some point. And then the two at the bottom, they're just other stuff, the web interface that we've got here and a REST API backend. Now, if I switch to another view of DCOS, you can see that I currently have 86%, which just dropped to 71%. It'll go back up again. But I've got high utilization in this cluster. There's no work going in here, but I have high utilization because I'm doing data mining in the background or whatever low priority job I want to work on. So I've got 71% of utilization across 7 nodes. Okay, so it's 7 individual VMs. How many people here run their systems at 70% utilization? When you need to be able to scale to massive increases in work just like that. Nobody. People who have to cope with significant scale changes typically run somewhere in the region of 20 to 30%. So let's see what happens. Let's simulate a couple of thousand orders per second. And that's what's going to happen if I set up 2 producers. This is going to start injecting work into the system at the rate of a couple of 100,000 a second. And there on the left, you see we're starting to see unprocessed things in the system. The time to process is going up because the queue is growing longer. But look at the analyzers. We've gone up from the one that it was before to eight. And the batch is reducing. Actually, why it's 2 of 8, I don't know. I wrote this code last night, so there you go. But it will, I promise you, it will go down in a moment. But it's making space. Okay, it's killing off some of those background processes in order to ensure that we make sure the queue length comes down. We're still at 71% utilization. You can see 86 now. You can see it going up and down as it's killing some of the background process off and starting up the new processes. 86% utilization. If I go back here, you can see we're now within our SLA. Took a few seconds. Even though I've gone from 0 to 2,000 orders per second. And I didn't do anything other than simulate the 2,000 orders per second. If I now kill those jobs, you can see the batch has now gone down to 0. Or you will when I get rid of this window. It's actually gone back up to 1 now because it's constantly adjusting the work that's going in the system. So I've now killed it, so there's no new work going into the queue anymore. There's just the residual stuff in the queue. And after a short period, you'll see the analyzers start to scale down. We're at 28. It'll probably go up to 30 before it starts to scale down, because it scales down much slower than it scales up, just in case there's a second spike just about to come. But we've gone up to 29. There we go. It's just started to drop. And now, because there's no work in the queue, it'll drop at around about 1 every 5 seconds. That's just the algorithm that we have inside of there. And when there's enough resources left in the machine, in the cluster, then the the batch job will scale up again. And if I go back to have a look at that, look, we've been constantly above 70% utilization. This is what you can do when you break your applications down into individual containers and you use a very powerful orchestrator to manage that workload, okay? You may see some failures on the right. I don't actually do it in this demo, but I actually have kind of a chaos monkey built into this system as well. So the two at the bottom, the REST query and the web, they're actually behind a load balancer, and there's a couple of them there, and they, every now and again, one of them will just randomly kill itself. And so that's what those failures are that you were seeing before. And of course, you don't see any effects because it's load balance, et cetera. You understand the principle. The orchestrators will handle that for you as well. So that's where you want to get to. How do you get to that? I should flick back to my thing because I forgot I was going to show you how you get to it. Not in full detail, but Saria showed you the 101 pieces of... Saria showed you the 101 pieces of how you do a Docker build and a Docker run. So the 50% of you in the room who have never done a Docker run, you should be listening to what Saria was doing and showing you how simple it is to run a Docker run. And you should go away and you should do a Docker run. You should amaze yourself at how just powerful this is for when you compare to standing up a VM instead of a container. Those of you who have done that, but put your hand down when I asked, have you orchestrated a large-scale application of multiple containers? This is an interesting piece to you. So what we have here is my web front end. And I've picked this one because it has more configuration about it than any other of the containers in here. Now, you can do everything I'm about to do through the REST interfaces or through the CLI. Ken showed you the CLI earlier on. Let's just zoom in there for you a bit. This just defines the actual application. I'm not going to go through the JSON for you. I'll go through the nice GUI instead in a moment. But the idea of showing you this is you write a JSON file, and then you submit it to the REST API, or you use the command line like Ken was doing earlier on. Let's just go back to the UI, though, and make it a little bit more palatable for people who've not seen this stuff before. So we give the application a name. So it's called microscaling/web. We tell it how many CPUs we want. We tell it how much memory, how much disk space, and how many instances we want. You can change the instances in real time. You saw it happening automatically, but you can go in here and change them manually if you want to as well. You define which Docker container you want to run. So there on the image, that's the name. Saria showed you, he said you create a tag. That's the tag. You provide any networking information that you need and a few other bits and pieces there. Here's the ports that I want to expose. This is a web container, so I want to expose port 80. environment variables can be injected into the container. So this same binary object can run in my production environment, can run in my test environment, can run in my dev environment, simply by changing the environment variables. And of course, you can inject secrets and things like that as well. Everything that I'm doing here happens in Swarm as well. So Soria showed you Swarm working earlier on, and he mentioned, well, you can inject environment variables and you can open ports. It's all the same thing because we're standardizing on that Docker image. This is just one orchestrator you could use in ACS. The other one is Swarm. We'll go down to health checks. I'll skip over labels in the interest of time. So the health check, this is the green bar at the bottom that said it was healthy. This is what this is for. It makes a call to this this location. It has a timeout and an interval, etc., and it decides whether it's healthy or not. If it's deemed unhealthy by the orchestrator based on the rules here, the orchestrator will kill it and start another one to make sure you've always got the right number of healthy containers. And again, if you're using Swarm, Docker Swarm, it does the same thing. Volumes we're not using in this case, but you can mount data volumes, etc. And we won't go through optional either. That's not not particularly important. Well, it is, but not for the purposes of this this demo. So that's how you. What we've done is we've gone from the first. Here's what you can do with containers when you've got a good orchestrator. We've gone through the 101, how you build a container, and then we've looked at how do you break up an application to be a containerized application and seen the results that can happen there. 80% utilization on my 7-node cluster saves me a lot of money. You know, I want you to buy compute time off me, but I want to make sure that it's cheaper for you to buy it from me than anybody else. So I'm going to try save you money. You want to run it on-premise, off-premise? No problem. We have our partners in Docker and Mesosphere. You can work with them. You can take the open source code. You can do it yourself. If you want to have their enterprise-supported products on top of ACS, remember the diagram we showed? We're collaborating on the same underlying infrastructure, so going to Docker Data Center or going to DCOS Enterprise Edition are easy. But what about Windows Server containers? We started on Windows Server containers, I showed Windows Server containers in the second demo, and of course we're at Ignite, and Windows Server containers are an important topic. So there's one thing I want to say about this. In Linux, there's a whole bunch of technologies, control groups, namespaces, layering capabilities, and so on, that have been around in the kernel for multiple years. I don't know the exact number, something in the region of 15 years. And these have been used in production in many different environments, etc., but they're deep down in the kernel. And to use these things, you really need to be a kernel kind of person, and I'm not. So along came this company called Docker. And Docker created some open source tooling. They created tooling like Docker Client, Docker Compose, Docker Swarm, Docker Registry, which made it easy for people like me to be able to build and run containers. Soria did the 101 demo. Soria's smarter than me, but I can do it too. And they built a REST interface against the engine that would manage these for you on the individual node, and they connected through to the Linux kernel. Okay, so Docker did not invent containerization. Docker made it accessible to the rest of us. And now Docker are moving on to address the orchestration piece. Mesosphere used the same underlying technologies, but DCOS and specifically Apache Mesos, which is at the lowest level in that stack, grew up in the big data space, things like Hadoop and Spark and so on, and they're using the same lower level technologies, and they've more recently added in support for the Docker images because Docker have made these tools around available. So in Windows Server containers, what the Windows Server team did is they built the compute services into the kernel of Windows. And these essentially provide the same functionality that you find in the Linux kernel. They then went and worked with the open source project, partnering with Docker, to provide any platform-specific code that we needed in order to run to talk to the Windows containers inside of the open source Docker engine. Inside of the open source Docker engine, not some separate thing that Docker and Microsoft have done independently and hidden around behind the scenes, but open source. Now, we all know Docker, Microsoft is a new company where open source is concerned, but I stopped using Microsoft products in 1998. I've been using Linux ever since. I joined Microsoft 3 years ago because of the change of the attitude towards open source, and I'm a big open source proponent. I actually am currently the president of the Apache Software Foundation. And so for me to stand up here and say, this is a fundamental part of the strategy, is very, very rewarding to me, and I believe the best thing for you as people out there in the ecosystem to be able to leverage the innovation that we're seeing. The pieces on top, those tooling that made it accessible to everybody, well, they're now working on Windows as well as on Linux. End of the line, what it means is it's the same set of tools, whether you're running Windows Server containers or whether you're running Linux containers, which means when we come to using things like Docker Swarm to orchestrate these applications, you're using the same tools. You don't have to learn two different sets of tools. You don't have to manage two sets of infrastructures. It's the same. But not everything is a Docker container. I mentioned a moment ago that Apache Mesos grew up in the Hadoop and the big data space. Some of you may have heard of the SMAC stack. Spark, Mesos, Akka, Cassandra, and Kafka. The M is Apache Mesos, and that's the underpinnings of the DCOS infrastructure. And so what you can do with DCOS is you can run these kinds of containers as well. You can containerize these workloads. Remember I said earlier on, there's nothing magic about the software that goes into a container. But you don't have to. You could run them in a more native environment or a more an optimized environment in some ways inside of a product like DCOS. And so with that, I want to bring Ken back to the stage. He woke up with a start for a moment. And Ken's going to show you a demo of how that might work inside of DCOS.
All right, back to number one. Perfect. Okay, a couple of thoughts here. First of all, just because we're running out of time, I actually preloaded a demo, but I wanted to show off a couple of things. Why don't we go in to DCOS, and while we're standing around and wait, actually, you know what? Let's do this. Let's do this from the command line. So DCOS, package, install, Kafka, and hopefully by the time I am done, we'll have a fully installed in a data center production ready Kafka. Now, one of the things that we've worked on at Mesosphere over this last 6 months, maybe a little bit longer, is the ability to, on the fly, be able to upgrade your version of Cassandra, Kafka, and a couple of other things in our data agility space, such that it can be upgraded with you just saying DCOS package upgrade Kafka to whatever version you're moving to, and it will upgrade it while it's running. Pretty amazing stuff what we're doing, so it's pretty exciting. The other thought that I had was the world's really changing, and it's kind of a mind stretch, right? And that change, we work with clients who actually have dev and production in the same cluster. So imagine that. Is that weird? You could be under certain businesses which would not tolerate that level of risk. But when the level of separation is based on whatever you're doing load balancing on, then it doesn't matter, right? You just hit the service endpoint, which is your load balancer, and magic happens. And when you have a Bieber event, right? Justin Bieber did something really awesome, and you have to know about it. We can actually move out dev and then increase production. That's the dynamicism we're talking about. But the problem that you run into, the challenge that we have when we start talking about that, is if it's that dynamic, if something can just land anywhere you want, how can I debug that? And as an ops person, what's our debugging tool? Tail, right? We got to be able to tail something, but where do I go? I need a static environment so I know what IP address and port to go to so I can start tailing something. Well, what if from the command line, I could hit Azure and get that information direct? So one of the things that we can do is I can say, you've seen me do this or any DCOS node. I can say DCOS task and see what's running in my environment. We can see a couple of things. One is I have three brokers already standing up for Kafka, so that might already be up for us. I have Cassandra up, and I have some nodes that have been started for us as well. And that was part of our prep work for the demo that we're about to do. But more importantly, I can also go in here and say DCOS task log, maybe a follow. Let's not follow yet. Let's just go in here and see what Cassandra's doing. So I do need to see that ID Or how about this, DCOS task? What if, like with brokers, what if I said DCOS task log? So I'm looking at the log. Now, you might be questioning, well, what am I really looking at? I'm actually looking at the standard out log. If I wanted to, I could actually specify I want standard error instead, or anything else that would be in the sandbox of the container itself. So it's some pretty cool stuff. But what I can also do is say, you know what, I want to follow that, and what I want to follow is something called broker. But I didn't specify the exact one. Now, this is going to be hard at this resolution, but what you're seeing is all three standard outs being followed at the same time. And the hard part is where the breaking point is. You can see the one right here where I have broker two now, broker one. I'm actually watching all three at the same time. Or I could go in there and say, I want this one, right? So all of that magic is kind of there already. So to be able to debug, understand, and see what's going on in our environment. And then we can start inspecting things that way as well. So as far as the remaining demo was concerned, it was a great presentation on what we can do with data agility. We have that idea of a SMAC stack, or we also, there's an architecture out there that's commonly used called the Lambda architecture, not Lambda as in Lambda, but Lambda as in architecture. Can be confusing, I know. And the idea of a Lambda architecture is that you have a slow track and a fast track, and we've seen this for years. When you are indexing the web and you're spidering out, you want fast indexes, but you also want accurate ones, and those are two different speeds. And so you may have an environment that has that similar kind of need. The demo that I have for you right now is this. I'm going to pull some data out of GitHub. I'm going to pull it through a fetcher. We've installed ahead of time Cassandra. We've installed Cairo as a way of doing time series data on top of Cassandra. And then I put in Graphenon as a way of viewing it. So let's take a look at what we have. First of all, I think we see all those things running. I went ahead and installed those ahead of time. The only complication there is I actually needed to see what those endpoints were. And they're fairly simple. It's just about getting the whatever service endpoint is. They can be pseudo-random unless you're already using a load balancer, which we could talk about if you want to come to the booth afterward. We can go into a lot more detail than this. All right, so we have that up and running. Whoops. Let's go out to the actual demo. First of all, this is us looking at Cairo. But that is less interesting. Let's look at Graphite. Here, the one difference is I actually need to import the layout of this thing. Oh, and I did a cleanup. That was not smart of me. There was one thing I should have left. there it is. All right, open that. And we can see that while we were talking, we actually had Cassandra stood up. You probably saw me get up here just as he started talking, as Ross started talking. I stood up Cassandra. I spun up a bunch of instances. They are pulling data. You can see this data is fairly up to date. Let's take a look at some things that are refreshed within the last few hours. So this is the number of pull requests happening on top of Marathon or Marathon UI or Spark. I'm actually hitting the Mesosphere GitHub repo. So other things that I would point you to that you might want to take a look at, and we'll make sure that they're available to you, is there's a great demo of Esri, which is a full Spark, Kafka, into Elasticsearch demonstration for which there's a GitHub repo on how to stand that up, as well as a whole IoT environment where we're standing up Kafka and Cassandra. So we'll make sure you get those URLs.
Excellent. Thanks. You.
Yep.
So the red light has just come on, just as you were finishing, so I shall just simply move to the last slide because there is an important short link there for you. How do you actually go about deploying these? Well, it's Azure. You can use the CLI, you can use ARM templates, you can use various configuration management tools, et cetera, et cetera. Just follow the link at the bottom, aka.ms/ACS, and that'll take you to the documentation. We don't have time for questions now. We will hang around for a little while here, but the three of us are going to be going down on the Microsoft booth. There's an Azure Container Service section down there, so feel free to come down and ask your questions there. Thank you very much.